In our recent studies in Daniel, we have just begun to consider the study ahead of us in Daniel chapter 11. We're right in the middle of an extended study, not just through the whole book of Daniel, of course. By the way, this is, according to my notes, this is the 70th study in the book of Daniel for us. And we're making good progress. We see the finish line out ahead, but we've got some good, rich, and deep material ahead of us. But we're in an extended study through the final vision of a series of visions that the Lord gave to Daniel. Each one, in a sense, building on the revelation of the previous vision, giving more detail, like a layer cake, each new vision layering another stage of understanding, tackling, for the most part, the same events in history. Of course, in advance, this is prophecy. This isn't just history written after the fact. This is history described before it actually happens, under the inspiration of God's Spirit. But a particular time period of history is in focus here. This final vision, like the previous ones, is covering what we would call the intertestamental era. This is the some 430 years. And this is just approximate. Could be a year or two either side, between Malachi, and we're talking not in our Bibles between Malachi in terms of where the books are located, but we're talking about historically in the chronology of events, between the time when Malachi, who is the last prophetic utterance, the last prophetic book of the Old Testament, and the arrival, of course, of the first announcements heralding the New Testament, the New Covenant, that being John the Baptist. All right, so this time period is in view. It's also associated with, in our study back in, all the way back in chapter 9, when we studied the famous vision of the 70 weeks of years, this time period of this final vision is focused on the 62 middle weeks of years, which comes to 434 years. That has to do with this same, those two numbers correlate to each other or correspond to each other. So on one side of the 62 weeks of years, there was 7 weeks of that 70 weeks total. And on the far end side, there was 1 week. We've seen that the 1 week, those events are focused on the first coming of Christ. That first week actually begins at the event of the baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist. And it carries forward for 3.5 years approximately, which is the same amount of time as the public ministry of Jesus, which takes us to the cross and the resurrection and ascension, all of which is the culmination point of God's great plan and purpose of salvation and redemption. So we're engaged not in the final week events, we studied that more when we were back in the 70 weeks, and not in that first 7 weeks of years, the first 49 years right after Daniel gave the prophecy, but now this vision that the Lord gives to Daniel focuses on this middle 62 weeks of years period. We've seen that this middle period is characterized as as the prophecy described it back in the 70 weeks prophecy, and this chapter is going to give a lot of details of that. This is a time of trouble. Now, what we mean by that, of course, is you can pick any moment in history. You could say, right now, is it a time of trouble in the world today? Most definitely. There, you know, all you have to do is turn on the television, open up any newspaper, look on any internet news portal, and you will see there is plenty of trouble going on in this big world, this big fallen, corrupted world, every day, all the time. But here, what we're focused on with this being a time of trouble is an intensified time of trouble. And not a time of trouble in a generic sense for the whole world's population, but this prophecy that the Lord gives to Daniel is focused on a particular group of people. And this trouble has to do with their experience primarily. And that group of people is God's covenant people, which at this time in history is Israel. Or we could more specifically refer to them as Judah, the Jewish people. All right, so that's our backdrop. That's our background. And we saw that in this final vision, what we're talking about, it's the lengthiest vision. It covers these three last chapters of the book of Daniel, chapters 10, chapters 11, and chapter 12. Chapter 10, we spent some time studying, which is the introductory material to this final vision. And it begins just like John's vision does in the book of Revelation, with first the Lord revealing himself directly and personally to the prophet that is going to receive this vision. Just like all of Revelation chapter 1 is really focused on the revelation of Jesus himself to John the Apostle. In this case, we saw back in chapter 10 that the Lord, in a pre-incarnate appearance, revealed himself to the prophet Daniel. And what's going to follow, just like in the book of Revelation, in our study now in chapter 11, is the details. But the details, it's important for us to keep straight. I'm about to launch into the details. The details are not unimportant by any means, but they're secondary. The primary thing of the vision is not all of the historical interesting facts and dates and characters and figures that we're going to find in chapter 11. The primary thing of the vision is the one that revealed himself back in chapter 10. Just like if you want to properly understand the revelation that God gave to John, the book of Revelation, you cannot properly understand the book of Revelation if you don't properly understand chapter 1. Because chapter 1 begins with a focus on the ascended Christ. And in the same way, the primary thing of this vision is Christ himself. The secondary thing is the details. And the point of the relationship between the two is how Christ the Lord is ruling over the details of these 600, or these 62 weeks of years, these 434 years of great intensified trouble for the covenant people. Because when they get into the midst of these events, as they're caught up in these events, as their lives are swirling with trouble, it's critically important that their hearts and lives are anchored to the primary thing of the vision, to the Lord himself. They recognize that he is in charge. Even though at moments in these various times of trouble that are ahead of them, it's going to seem like the king of Persia is in charge of all this, or the king of Greece is in charge of all this. But the truth of the matter is, the Lord in heaven is in charge of all of this. Let me just remind you, we've read this before, and we've actually focused on it a couple of times in our study through Daniel, but let me take you to three verses, not in chapter 11. I will come back to chapter 11, we'll read the details, but let's rehearse these three verses. Way back 70 studies ago, and I'm going to take you to Daniel 4:25 first. Way back 70 studies ago, when we began our study through the book of Daniel in the introductory study, I identified these three verses as the key verses of the entire book of Daniel. They remain the key verses. And these are not arbitrary selections on my part. I believe these verses are meant by the Lord to kind of focus our understanding on what we're really meant to get from all of this prophecy. The first one, Daniel 4:25, and all three of these are very similar. They're kind of repetitions of a singular principle. The first, Daniel 4:25, states that you shall be driven from among men. This is Daniel speaking to King Nebuchadnezzar after he had had a dream that he was confused by and didn't understand, and sought out understanding among the wise men of his kingdom, and none could answer but Daniel, and this is the Lord's answer through Daniel to the king, that you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and you shall be wet with the dew of heaven, and 7 periods of time, that 7 years, shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Now let's skip down in the same chapter to verse 32. It's repeated a second time to him, as the Lord often does repeat himself on these key points. And you shall be driven from among men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and you shall be made to eat grass like an ox, and 7 periods of time shall pass over you until you know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will. Final passage, very similar, is in chapter 5, verse 21. He was, this is now after the fact, more of a historical description of the event, he was driven from among the children of mankind. That's referring to Nebuchadnezzar. And his mind was made like that of a beast, and his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. He was fed grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. So what are we meant to understand from the book of Daniel as a whole? And what are we meant specifically to understand from our study of Daniel chapter 11? We're meant to understand that the Most High rules over the kingdoms of mankind, and he gives it and sets over it whom he will. So let's turn to chapter 11 and see how the events detailed in chapter 11 just simply confirm this same core essential point that is made repeatedly over and over again through all of the instruction in Daniel, through all of the prophecy in Daniel, and through all of the events in Daniel's life. We'll read for tonight just the first 4 verses of chapter 11. We touched on them in our previous study, but we're going to develop all the details of these verses. And then the next section that we'll start on next week, Lord willing, starts in verse 5. I had, just as a preview, I had told you that what we're heading into is one of the more complex and historically detailed sections of the entire book of Daniel. It's going to be somewhat easy for us to get lost in the details. I will just say this for tonight. I think this shouldn't lose you tonight, these first 4 verses, because we've actually studied this material. Now, we've studied it in different chapters before we got here, because really these first 4 verses are describing the same events again from a different perspective that have previously been described in previous prophecies by the Lord to Daniel. First, in prophecies that had to do with imagery, like the fight between a goat and a ram and the horns of those animals. Now, these same events are being described without the imagery, just describing them as historical events in advance before they actually happen. It's in verse 5 and beyond that we're going to have to slow down a little bit, and we're going to have to make sure I don't lose you in the historical events. That doesn't mean that we won't have some detail to deal with tonight, but it should be somewhat familiar to you. So let me give myself some board room, and then we'll head into these first 4 verses. All right, Daniel 11, verse 1. And as for me, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. Now, it's very common when Christians get into passages like this that they read it and they recognize immediately, I'm in over my head. You know, you read a passage, just the four verses I read, and you just instantly recognize this is talking about some deep prophetic stuff here, and I'm in over my head. So we just kind of tend to shift into a kind of like just a glassy-eyed reading of the text, and I'm just kind of read fairly rapidly so that I can get to some more familiar territory and footing. Maybe I'll read some in the book of Proverbs after I'm done with this, just so I can feel like I know what I'm understanding, or I'm understanding what I'm reading. But I hope you understand this point now. There is nothing, and I mean literally nothing, in God's word that he has revealed that he does not want us as his people to understand. And not just kind of understand, not just, you know, maybe on the edges of understanding, but to really grasp and to understand exactly what the passage is communicating and detailing for us. And this passage is meant to be understood by us, and we should not be confused or left guessing as to what these prophetic descriptions are connected to in real and actual history. All of the book of Daniel fits, if this is the timeline of history with that X representing the Garden of Eden, and this arrow at the far right of the timeline of history representing the beginning of eternity. So from Eden to eternity, we have a line of history. All of the events of the book of Daniel fit somewhere on this line. Of course, the problem is, where do they fit on the line, and what specific events of history do they correspond to? So that's, of course, the goal, the task of our study tonight. Now, the first thing, I'm not going to focus too much attention on verse 1. We studied that in some detail in our prior study. But I do want to catch this phrase in verse 2, which has to do with what the point I was just making. And now I will show you the truth. Anybody remember who's speaking here? This is the angelic messenger, and we've interpreted this messenger as the Lord himself speaking to Daniel the prophet. And he, before he shifts from the initial introduction of revealing himself to Daniel into the detailed description of the events that are going to follow in chapter 11, he stops in the transition from the vision of seeing him to the details of the events that are going to happen, and he introduces it this way. Now I will show you the truth. Does that imply that what he had just shown him in chapter 10 was not the truth? No, not at all. The truth was revealed in the appearance of the Lord himself in chapter 10. But now what he wants to emphasize to Daniel is that the events that he's about to detail, all of the events of chapter 11, are real. Real historic events. There are some schools of Bible prophecy that look at passages like this and they kind of just blur them into general principles that apply to all moments and events of history. General spiritual principles that are not meant to correspond to any actual and real specific events, but just generally speak to any believer at any moment in history. Well, is it true that these passages speak to us about things in our lives and our hearts today. Yes, absolutely, they are meant to be applicable to all moments and events of history, but we don't have to blur them into a general kind of spiritualization, because these events correspond not to every moment in history as they address history. They correspond to specific and particular events and moments in history. All right, so let's launch into the first one. What's the very first historic detail that the Lord gives to Daniel in this final unfolding vision? After he tells him, I'm going to show you the truth about what's to come, about these, what I'm calling these 62 weeks of years, this time of trouble. The first detail is, behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia. Behold. Why does the Lord ever use this word when he's talking to a prophet? Behold. Yeah, it's just an attention-getting device. The Lord uses these communication devices just like parents do when they're speaking to their kids. Look, pay attention. I want your full heart's attention to notice this. So behold, what does he say to him? Three more kings shall arise in Persia. All right, we had left off back in the end of chapter 10. Let's just read one verse from the end of chapter 10 just to remind ourselves. Verse 20, chapter 10, verse 20. Then he said, do you know why I have come to you? But now I will return to fight against the prince of Persia. And when I go out, behold, the prince of Grecia will come. Now, we're not going to develop all of the implications of the terminology of fighting, other than to say, as we studied, this is descriptions to us of behind the scenes spiritual warfare. And there's some very important principles contained in that. But what we did notice is that these events, the events of this final vision, have to do not with the entire 70 weeks of prophecy, which covers really four great world empires, as the original first vision of Daniel, from Babylon to the Medo-Persian Empire to the Greek Empire to the Roman Empire. This one is focused just on the middle two empires. This vision is focused on events connected to Persia and Greece. So the middle two empires in the progression of the four great world dominating empires of this time in history are in focus here. The middle empires are the empires of Persia and Greece. Remember, the Persian Empire started as a dual empire, a combined empire, the empire of the Medes and the Persians. But we saw from our study in prior prophecies that the Medes were ultimately overwhelmed by the Persian faction within that empire, and it came to be known strictly as the Persian Empire. And then, of course, the Greeks and under Alexander the Great are going to follow. So the focus here is on those middle two empires. And here, the first detail of the final prophecy is three more Persian kings are going to arise. Well, the question we have to ask is, arise starting from what starting point? If these events have to do with very specific and particular events of history, as opposed to generally applying to all events, then we have to have some event to detail that for us. So just as our anchor point, turn back to the beginning of chapter 10. Remember, our prophecy here is all three of the final chapters. Chapter 10, chapter 11, and chapter 12 are one singular prophecy. Here's how chapter 10 starts. It starts with a historic detail that gives us a starting point to understand, well, where do we start these three more kings? Where do we start that count from? Chapter 10, verse 1. In the third year of Cyrus, king of Persia, a word was revealed to Daniel, who was named Belteshazzar, and the word was true, and it was a great conflict, and he understood the word and had understanding of the vision. So the events of chapter 11 are being told to Daniel the very same day as chapter 10, verse 1. So who is the king of Persia as Daniel is listening to the Lord speak? Anyone? Who is, okay, Cyrus is the present king of Persia. This prophecy in chapter 11, let's go back to chapter 11 now, verse 2 tells us, behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia. So where do we start the count of three more kings? With Cyrus. So what we're looking for is king number one, king number two, and king number three following Cyrus. And that's going to lead us up to, as it continues on in verse 2, we're in chapter 11, verse 2, three more kings shall arise in Persia, in the next detail, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. So we have a total of four kings, one, two, three, four, that are following King Cyrus of Persia. And the reason the Lord goes into such specific detail is because he doesn't want us to misunderstand, well, which king is he talking about? Because when we get to the specifics of which actual real life historic king of Persia is connected to king number one, number two, number three, and number four, by the time we get to number four, we'll see, oh, I see how that all fits together. I see how that connects. The Lord really was in great detail describing history to us in advance. All right, so this information that I'm about to lay out is not found in the Bible directly. This is now where we have to do a little bit of historical background work, cultural background work, and then we compare what's described in Scripture with the real events of history, because thanks to archaeology, we do know when Cyrus ruled Persia. We know when his rule began. We know when his rule ended. We know the specific years of the beginning and the end of the rule of Cyrus. And we know who the four kings were that followed Cyrus. Now, this is not always true with every kingdom of the world. For instance, if I said to you, you know, who was the king of the Moogaboogas, you know, on some island in the Pacific? You wouldn't necessarily know, and I wouldn't either, because we haven't discovered that information. But Persia was such a world-dominating empire, and there is so much of a historical and archaeological record that's left behind, we have very specific information that tells us so that we can connect each event and each king to specifics. All right, so who was the first king that followed Cyrus? Now, I'm going to give you this information. This isn't super critical for your heart. The only benefit of going through this and putting the names and dates on the board, I don't want to lose you. Like, I remember, I'm a lover of history, and I always loved history. But even so, I can remember sitting in a history class in school and kind of like, you know, being overwhelmed with the recitation of names and dates. And at a certain point, your brain just checks out. I don't want you to check out on this information. I will say, as I give you like king number one, two, and three, if you don't remember their names and the dates connected to them 6 months from now, I'm not going to fault you for it. I don't think it's going to be a problem for you. The whole point of understanding this is so that the main points that the passage is making are solidified in your heart and mind and understanding, so that you know the Lord really was in charge of these events, because he described exactly in detail these events before they actually happened. I'll say, okay, so king number one, Cambyses, and don't hold me to the pronunciation because I'm no expert in ancient Persian pronunciation. I'm just giving it my best shot. Cambyses was the very first king that followed Cyrus. He ruled from the years, Cyrus's rule ended in 530 BC. Cambyses ruled from 530 to 522. These are all B.C., so some 8 years of time. Then, and I'll tell you the backstory of why this strange name. The next ruler was Pseudosmerdes. Trust me, I don't come up with this stuff, you know. This is not made up. You can find this in historical texts. He was also known as Gaumata. And he lived and ruled for 1 year, 522 only. And I'll go back and I'll describe why he was called Pseudo in just a moment. And then he was succeeded by Darius. Last name, Hystaspes. And he ruled from 522 to all the way to 486. So he had a long rule. All right. This middle king, it's not critical to our prophecy study, but it's an interesting side note of history. That's Smerdes. I left out an R there. Not Smedes. All right, how'd you like to be known forever in history? I am King Pseudo Smerdes. You know, pseudo means false. The issue was Cambyses had a younger brother. And it looked like his younger brother was going to take the kingdom next after Cambyses would die. And Cambyses and his younger brother had, you know, some friction, as often happened in ancient kingdoms. And there was some behind-the-scenes palace intrigue. And Cambyses took his brother out of the picture. And then he went off to war, as Persian kings often did, because remember, in our study of the Persian Empire, earlier in the prophecy of Daniel, we saw that it was the most expansive world-dominating empire up until that moment of history. They had extended their borders beyond any other empire in world history. And Cambyses, as kings often did, would lead that conquest. And so he, after taking out his brother, whose name was Smerdes, he left for the wars. When he came back, he discovered there was a look-alike, someone that looked like his brother Smerdes, and who had presented himself. His actual name was Gaumata. He presented himself before the court while Cambyses was gone. And in those days, you couldn't just, you know, pick up your cell phone and check with Cambyses. Is, you know, do you want your brother to take the rule? When the king left the palace, he might be gone leading his armies in war for months. And there were messengers, but messengers would take at least weeks to travel from one location to another. And so Smerdes, this not the true Smerdes, but a man who looked just like him, presented himself because the murder of the true Smerdes was secretive behind the scenes. And so he presented himself as though he was the real Smerdes, and he became king of Persia. And that lasted for just as long as it took Cambyses to get back from the war. And then he didn't last any time beyond that. But nevertheless, he ruled for that year, almost a full year's time in 522 BC. And then, of course, Darius took over from there and ruled for a lengthy period of time. All right, so these three kings, this prophecy tells us that three kings are going to arise after the first great king that's in focus, which is Cyrus. And so these kings correspond here. Cyrus is this first one, and then Cambyses, Pseudo-Smerdes, and Darius take the center stage for their own periods of rule. That brings us up to the next detail, which is the fourth king. And the fourth king is really the focal point of the passage. Let's go back to 11:2. Now I will show you the truth. Behold, three more kings shall arise in Persia, and a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. The fourth king was known as, actually two names, Xerxes, that's X-E-R-X-E-S, and he's also identified in Scripture by another name, Ahasuerus. I'll take you to that passage in just a moment. All right, so these two names are the same person, same individual. We're just dealing with different languages communicating the same identity, the same person. Now, Xerxes ruled for these years, 486 to 465. So everything under the line here now is going to be details connected to Xerxes. Xerxes, 486 BC to 65? 65 BC. All right, what are we told in this prophecy before we go to the other passages? What are we told about him? A force shall be far richer. Now that's a tall order for Persian kings. All four of these Persian kings were what we would consider to be fabulously wealthy, beyond measure, like Solomon level wealthy. But Xerxes exceeded all of them, including Cyrus the Great, who was a tremendously wealthy king, so much so that just on a spiritual whim, it was driven and influenced by the Spirit of God, but he personally, out of his own treasury, funded the entire return of the covenant people of God, the Israelites who were held in captivity in his kingdom, funded their return to the promised land, funded the rebuilding of the temple, funded the rebuilding of the city of Jerusalem. And that was just a side project for him because his main expenditures were in his own Persian kingdom. So Xerxes is going to be far richer than Cyrus, than Cambyses, than Pseudo-Smerdes, and Darius. We'll look at a passage in the Bible that actually describes this for us in just a moment. The other detail. And when he has become strong through his riches. So what we're looking for is a historical verification that Xerxes was far richer than the other Persian kings, and he became strong through riches. We don't have a Bible passage for that, but I will just confirm from history and from archaeology that one of the things that Xerxes became known for is he built the largest yet army, the largest yet in history, standing army. And he did so because he essentially paid for it. He opened his treasuries and he hired men from his kingdom and all the surrounding lands to build the largest standing army, which then funded his desire and intention to go out and conquer more lands than had ever been conquered in history up until that point. So this is absolutely confirmed that he was strong through his riches, and we'll look at a passage that identifies how he was far richer. Okay, let's keep our place in Daniel 11, and let's turn then to a parallel passage that describes these same events. First, chapter 9 of Daniel, verse 1. Just a single verse. We, of course, studied this already, but I left this detail out when we were in that passage on purpose, saving it for this time. In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. Now, I'm identifying Xerxes with Ahasuerus, and he follows Darius, right? But here, it says in the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. All that means is that Ahasuerus was himself the son of Darius, and then as kings often did in honor of their father, he turned around and he had a son that he named after his own father. So this Darius, in our list of the three, or actually four kings, was Darius the first. And then the Darius in chapter 9 is the second Darius in a line of what then became multiple Darius named Persian kings. But here we have the mention of Ahasuerus. This Ahasuerus is, all solid Bible scholars agree on this point, is identified with the Persian king Xerxes. Now let's look at another passage. find the book of Esther. And we will connect this to an account of a key event earlier in Bible history. This is after the book of Nehemiah and just before Job. And we're going to look at Esther chapter 1. This is how the story of Esther unfolds. I think you're probably familiar with the events of Esther. They have to do with events during the time of Israel's captivity in Persia and events connected to a specific Persian king. That specific Persian king is Ahasuerus, Xerxes, the fourth king following Cyrus the Great. And of course, it has to do, the rest of the book, we won't get into that in this first portion, has to do with the Lord's sovereign hand in saving Israel, saving the Jews from a plot, a conspiracy to have them all murdered. But before we get there, and we won't get to that tonight, we're just going to look at the first six verses of Esther chapter 1. Now, in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Xerxes, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia. Now, India, of course, is on the far east of Persia, and Ethiopia is on the far south of their kingdom, of their empire. This is a tremendously large landmass. Again, the largest and most extensive empire that the world had ever seen. The Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital. Now we encounter Susa in Daniel's prophecies because Daniel, for one of the visions that he was given, was in Susa, the capital of Persia. So he sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital. In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. Now what we're about to read is the description of this feast, how long it lasted, what was the expense connected to the feast. And the point of this story is to just detail and demonstrate the extreme riches that this king possessed. Let's read a few verses of this feast that he threw in his own army, in his own honor, basically. In the third year of his reign, verse 3, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media, this is when the Medes and the Persians were still somewhat linked together, and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. Now, what does that describe? What that describes is this was a feast in which he fed not just all his government officials, he fed his entire combined army of Persia and Media and his entire government. That's who he threw this feast for. Verse 4, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. How long does that last? That's a six-month feast. Not just for, just put it in context of your own personal financial circumstances. What if you were to just throw a feast for one friend for 6 months? How would that affect your finances? Now, I'm not talking about you take them to McDonald's and buy them off of the value menu, you know. I'm talking about a feast for, prime rib, for just one friend. And you were to do that every day for 6 months, would that have some dent, effect on your budget? He did this for all of his government. This is governors and sub-governors of 127 provinces, plus the combined armies of Persia and Media. And his armies were in the multiplied hundreds of thousands, some estimate at about 1 million soldiers. And he provided them not a meager meal, but a feast that lasted for 6 straight months. How rich was this guy? There was just there's no measuring it, is the point of the passage. And when those days, verse 5, were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. So, you know, that's the first feast isn't enough. Now he's going to throw a feast, a secondary feast, for everybody in the capital city. And again, there were multiplied thousands of just general population in the capital city. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, whatever that is, I don't know, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, not just for the head table. Anyone that was part of the feast was served their drink in a golden vessel, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion, for the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti, that's his wife at the time, also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. All right, and then the story of the events of Esther unfold from there. All of that, we just, you know, we took a side journey into Esther to just verify the single small detail of prophetic information that the Lord gave to Daniel years before the events actually occurred. Remember, does anybody remember about what time Daniel is receiving this vision? He's around 600 BC. And now Ahasuerus Artaxerxes is somewhere after the year 486. So this is a minimum of 115 years before these events occur. The Lord gives a message to Daniel to say, there is going to be a succession of kings that will follow the king that you're familiar with, who's ruling over Persia right now, over the empire that you're part of right now. Cyrus was king as Daniel received the vision of chapter 11. And following Cyrus, there's going to be a succession of three kings. He doesn't name them, but we're able to identify them and link them with the real events of history. And then there's going to be a fourth king, which he stops. He doesn't do this for the intervening three kings, but the fourth king is going to be significant. He's going to play, the implication is he's going to play a special role. What role does he play? The role of the events of the book of Esther. And that is going to be part of the troubled time of this whole time period that these events are unfolding in. This isn't the only trouble, but it was a big, it was troublesome. The threat was every single Jewish person was ordered to be executed. And this was the Lord's sovereign intervention through, of course, the influence of Esther and how the Lord had situated her and placed her in exactly the right place at the right moment in history. And out of the testimony of her own heart, she said, she came to understand through the teaching of her uncle, for such a time as this, she had come into this position. She actually succeeded Vashti as queen of Persia and forestalled and persuaded Xerxes, Ahasuerus, to not carry out the order of execution against all the Jews, and the Lord preserved them alive during one of the great times of trouble. But this is just one of a series of troubling events that Israel is going to face during this 62 weeks of the middle portion of the 70 weeks of prophetic years. All right, let's go back now with all of that side journey. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 11, pick up the next element of the prophecy. We left off in chapter 11, verse 2. And a fourth shall be far richer than all of them. That's Xerxes Ahasuerus. And when he has become strong through his riches, meaning at the height of his power, when he built the greatest and strongest, biggest, baddest army ever in history up until that moment, when he has become strong through his riches, what's going to happen? He shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. It came into Xerxes' heart, I need to expand my boundaries to the west. I've already expanded my boundaries all the way to the east. He conquered all the way to India. He had expanded his boundaries all the way down across the Mediterranean into Africa, down into Ethiopia. But to immediately to the west, and this is, if you have a study Bible with maps, maybe you'll have a map that describes this. I'm going to be really bad at doing this, so I'm not going to put all the details in. Okay, Persia is here, and it goes right up to the coast of what was known as the Aegean Sea. The Aegean Sea is just a small portion or section of the larger Mediterranean Sea. Greece is a peninsula that was directly across from the Aegean Sea. And so it came into the heart of Xerxes. I've expanded to the south, I've expanded to the east, and he had expanded already to the north. We saw this in one of the prior prophetic portions that we studied. And now I need to expand to the west, and Greece is standing in my way. And so he formed this invasion army. He made a giant fleet in those days of some 300 ships. I mean, you could march around on the land, but it was a much more difficult passage than to just sail directly across and land and invade the territory that he wanted to conquer. So he, you know, put his gigantic army on his ships, as many as he could hold, sailed across to Greece, and he began to conquer Greece and was very successful in doing so until he was stopped in a specific, a particular battle of history. It was known as the Battle of Salamis. I won't go into details about the battle other than it was a naval battle, and he was outmaneuvered. And this took place, just for a reference point, in the year 480 BC. So he came into power 486. 6 years later, he had built his giant army, sailed across, began to conquer, and then in a key battle down here, right off the southern coast in this area, he was outmaneuvered and lost a big naval battle and withdrew and retreated. We see the description here says, he shall stir up all against the kingdom of Greece. At that point, the prophecy doesn't describe what happens, other than it describes the next event. The next event starts in verse 4. And what we're left to do is we're left to discern what verse 4 is describing, because we're not given a historic reference point. We have to now put two and two together and come up with the correct answer of what event connects with this prophecy. So we leave off with this King Xerxes stirring up all of the Empire of Persia against Greece, and he goes to invade Greece. He stopped there. And the next event that unfolds is in verse 4, verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. All right, what we would tend to think is, since we're dealing with a historical progression of Persian kings, then what we're thinking maybe is that there's a fifth Persian king that's going to arise. But that is not the case. Why? How can we know with prophetic certainty that this is not describing a fifth Persian king? Because the prophecy said there's going to just be four. Now, that doesn't mean that there were no other Persian kings after this, but if it was a fifth king, it would have been identified prophetically for us as a fifth king. So this new king, this mighty king, is something new, something different, And actually, this is now, let me get rid of these three kings up here. This mighty king in verse 3 is now mighty king. Is Alexander the Great. Not a Persian king at all, but a Greek king. Technically, at the beginning, a Macedonian king, which is a province just directly to the north of Greece, up here in this area. But his father, Philip of Macedon, which later, by the way, the Greek city of Philippi was named for Philip of Macedon. We have in our New Testament the book of Philippians, which was named after Alexander's father, that city was. Anyway, this region is where the Macedonian Empire started, but it eventually consolidated and conquered all of Greece. And what we see in verse 3 is, then a mighty king shall arise. Now, I'm saying this mighty king is now not a Persian king at all. He's a Greek king. He's Alexander the Great. And the question is, am I just like pulling stuff out of thin air to associate this mighty king of verse 3 with a specific king named Alexander the Great and shifting from Persians to Greeks? No, we're not pulling stuff out of thin air. What we're doing is we're doing a little prophecy detective work. Like Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock Holmes functions on a principle that we call deductive reasoning. He looks at the evidence in front of him, and he's not like some mysterious character who can just, you know, like through spiritual inspiration arrive at the right conclusion. He looks at the evidence at hand, and he just notices details. And puts details together with other details in a way that he arrives at correct and right understanding of what actually happened. And that's what we're left to do at this point in the prophecy. Some portions of God's word in terms of prophecy spell things out for us very specifically, like the progression of the Persian kings. Cyrus leading to the 1, 2, 3, 4 kings to follow. Other portions like this, the very next verse, leave us to deduce who this king is connected to. And we can do that by comparing the description in the prophecy as it leaves off with king number 4, and then what happens following the events of king number 4 in history as the description is unfolding. So let's read verses 3 and 4 together as a unit. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do as he wills. And as soon as he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not to his posterity, nor according to the authority with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up and go to others besides these. Did that happen, those events of verse 3 and 4, to any of the Persian kings that followed Xerxes, Ahasuerus? And the answer is no. It is true that the Persian Empire was conquered, but it was conquered by Alexander the Great. And the Persian Empire was never divided into four sections. But as we saw in a prior study, all the way back in chapter 8, the Greek Empire after Alexander was divided into four sections. And so what we're doing is we're putting the chapter 8 prophecy together with the details of the chapter 11 prophecy and arriving at the correct understanding that we're dealing with Alexander the Great as the mighty king. All right, so let's detail a couple of these things before. You know what? I'm going to save that as the introduction to the next section. I'm going to save Alexander the Great and how this connects to the prior passages that we've studied, because we're at the end of the study and I don't want to give this like 1 minute's time. It's important for us as we move forward to be able to hold our understanding of what we learned in chapter 8 and connect it with the events that are about to unfold in chapter 11 and see that this is talking about the exact same thing that this is talking about, just two different descriptions of the same event. So we'll dig into that and develop that together, Lord willing, next time. God bless.